Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of 1999's Best Picture winner, American Beauty, by the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, Doug.
You can't see me right now, but I'm blushing.
You're the plastic bag in my heart.
My roses, my cheeks are rose-hued.
And pouring on top of me as I jerk off in bed. Hey, everyone. Welcome to F This Movie. My name's
Patrick. So what Tuesday?
If this is your first time listening to the show, visit us at fthismovie.net.
And I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have stuff every day. And you can find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. Listen to us on Stitcher, if that's your bag. Follow us on Twitter. We're at F This Movie. Like our page on Facebook. And as always, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. I have a backlog of emails right now that I have not responded to. I have read them, but I apologize for having not responded. I promise I will. Tonight's show was actually recommended. American Beauty was actually suggested to us a while back by Aaron Mansfield, a listener. And
Boy or girl?
Boy.
Oh.
And rats. We actually, Douglas and I just sort of came up with doing this show. We said, well, we probably have stuff to say about American Beauty. And then I thought, well, let me search back in the F This Movie emails if anyone has ever recommended it. So these two things happen sort of independently of one another. If we ever do a show that you recommended and you don't get credit, I apologize. It's just because we get a lot of suggestions, and I'll try and be better about searching to see if anyone has suggested it before.
And Poe Buddy's nerficked.
Even exactly. Thank Patrick you. Bromley. Thank you for saying it. Douglas, you're back on the show.
Even you, by the way, who like reads emails and doesn't respond like a dickbag.
Yeah.
Total dickbag move.
You're back on the show, back in California. The last time you were on the show, you were here.
That's right.
In Shiki G. And
it's like, I'm over here or I'm over here. you never know where I'm going to be.
We had our all-night slumber party.
Right.
Since then...
I have not washed my hair. It's still in a braid.
Oh, wow. That was a while ago. But since then, have you seen anything good?
Oh, my goodness. I've seen so much. I've really gotten back in the habit of watching things almost every night. And
That's awesome. For a while,
I was watching a lot of TV also, which
House
I know
of Cards.
I did watch all of House of Cards in about 2 weeks.
Super good.
We've talked offline about this, and obviously this isn't about TV, but I think you and I can both agree that that show is markedly overrated and kind of ridiculous. And while it has some good elements, I'm flabbergasted by its popularity and flabbergasted by so much of the ridiculousness that goes on in the actual show. I realize it's drama, but it's also a soap opera. Let's be honest.
It's very much a soap opera. And I wonder, I don't want to spend too much time on House of Cards, but I wonder if my dislike of Kevin Spacey's performance on that show
informed
part of this rewatch of American Beauty.
I think, there's something to that, because I watched it last night and I couldn't help but think of Frank Underwood. That's my impersonation of him, by the way. You might hear more of that later. It's horrible. So I've watched a lot of TV.
A year
and I've also
from
watched...
now, I'll be dead. All right, sorry. I know. All right. What have you watched?
I've watched a ton of movies. A lot of really, really bad stuff, like The Internship, which is just garbage. But of course, I knew it was garbage going in, which is part of the reason I went in, because at the time I watched The Internship, I wanted to watch garbage. I've watched stuff because I was in the mood for football, because football season has started, and I watched Draft Day when no one else saw Draft Day.
So I saw that shit in the theater.
Are you – what? Why? I did not know that. Why did you see Draft – you don't even – you kind of marginally like Chicago Bears football.
Yeah.
But you don't really – you're not a sports fan necessarily.
Not really. If I was going to watch anything, it would be football. I don't know. It looked okay. I was interested in the idea of how once upon a time – they made movies about the sport of football, and now they make movies about the business of football. I'm kind of fascinated by that.
And it's such I want to call it boring, because it's not necessarily boring. There's
it's
definitely
fine,
stakes,
right?
But it's just like when you really step back and think, like, what are they? This is all like about a draft pick. It's so silly.
Yeah.
No, there are no stakes.
It borrows a lot from Jerry Maguire. That scene with Frank Langella where they go to the amusement park is one of the most hilarious, terrible things in a movie this year. And Jennifer Garner desperately needs new representation.
Yeah, she's just wasted. Although I did like in that movie, her character is not she doesn't have to be, I feel like in so many sports movies, the female character has to be one of the boys and has to really be ballsy and step up and kind of, she's not that way. She's a strong character. I feel like there's elements of strength in her character, and she doesn't have to be the cartoonish, like, put people in their place by being brassy. She just is a strong character, and I kind of like that element of it a little bit, but again, I'm really kind of picking and choosing, I guess.
Where in your top 10 for 2014 does Draft Day fall, I guess, is
the question. Can one movie take more than one position, is my question to you.
Ivan Reitman has not lost it.
Okay, I want to say one thing. It's not really a spoiler, but I guess kind of minor spoiler for Draft Day. One of the very early scenes, you find out that Jennifer Garner is pregnant with Kevin Costner's baby.
Right.
And one of the last scenes, when everything else is kind of resolved, and again, it has nothing to do with, like, we know she's pregnant, so this isn't a spoiler. He turns to his mom after, like, all this tension, and he goes, "Hey, Mom, I'm gonna have a baby." And it's the most laughable thing in the entire movie. And it was like midnight here when I'm in bed with just the glow of the computer. I'm watching this, and I'm just like, "What am I watching? This is insane."
Yeah.
So yeah, Draft Day. I haven't seen too much in the theater itself. I saw Guardians of the Galaxy, which you guys have covered numerous times. It's great. Whatever. But yeah, just a lot of stuff caught up on Netflix. A lot of things, you know, like that. So I don't know. I can't think of anything right now off the top of my head that I've seen that I want to recommend.
I was throwing out like recommendations to you for a few days there, like Cheap Thrills, which I can't remember if we talked about. Blue Ruin. You watched Blue Ruin.
I did watch Blue Ruin.
Do you want to talk about any of these movies?
Cheap Thrills, I feel like I talked about on a previous podcast.
Maybe you did.
It's great, and it's such a kind of small,
I think you had watched it movie. When we did Best Friend Slumber Party.
Yeah. And Blue Ruin I watched, and I honestly don't remember that much about it. I remember liking it. It was probably over a month ago, and this obviously is the problem of not doing podcasts very often, just by virtue of me being far away.
Yeah.
I don't talk to you as much about this stuff on the show as I normally would, so I don't remember it as much. I know you really, really like Blue Ruin. I liked it fine. It's not a movie that's going to stick with me, okay. I don't think. I also saw that movie you recommended. It's about the kids playing war.
I Declare War.
And I feel like that's in a similar vein as Blue Ruin, where I saw it and I really liked it at the time, but I kind of forgot. It hasn't stuck with me like it stuck with you.
So the category being great movies that you are unable to appreciate.
Pretty much. And let's talk about Draft Day.
Movies with not enough football drafting. I can't remember, because it was months ago that I saw the movie. How many glasses of his own pee does Kevin Costner drink in that movie?
Well, I think the highlight of it is when he is about to draft a Heisman winning quarterback.
Yeah,
and calls him retard.
Oh, okay, that's top. Do you know that one of the directors of I Declare War, who is a Canadian, Jason Lapierre, I don't know how to say his name.
I believe his name is Mraz.
And he also made a movie called Cold Blooded, which is on Netflix, and I kind of recommend that. Was the director of the Saved by the Bell behind-the-scenes movie that premiered on Lifetime last week and is one of the worst things. Somehow it managed to be worse than an episode of Saved by the Bell. So
let's be honest. You have a fondness for Saved by the Bell. I wouldn't say you love the show. Well, right. Yeah, you love the show, right? Right. You love it.
I'm well-versed in the SBTV.
You want to have a million of its babies.
10,000 of its babies.
We grew up with Saved by the Bell, and you were kind of obsessed with it for a little bit, but obviously you can sell that and you've admitted that it's a very flawed thing. Your watching of this Lifetime movie of Saved by the Bell,
yeah.
Is it because you loved Saved by the Bell, or was it because you loved I Declare War and the director of
I did not movie? Know he had directed it when I
oh, really?
Saw it and was watching it thinking, this is one of the most poorly directed things I've ever seen.
And then you saw the director credit, were you just like, I am very confused right now?
Yeah. It was like someone you trusted betraying you in a terrible way.
Is it like your best friend moving to California?
It's a lot. Saying? It's a lot like that. A lot like that. I saw – what have I seen? I went to see the 4K re-release of Ghostbusters. Speaking of Ivan Reitman still having it, I took my son, who's 5, and I was a little worried that he was going to be freaked out by stuff, but he liked it. And – we did a podcast on that movie, 3 or 4 years ago. We've been around too long now to the point where it's like, yeah, once upon a time we did something on that. That movie is the best. Obviously, I'm not reporting any news to anyone, but I'm just amazed at how well That movie still holds up, still plays. Every single line of dialogue is funny and quotable. I really think that movie is like a crazy comedy masterpiece, and it made me sad for the loss of Harold Ramis.
Is Ghostbusters PG or PG-13?
PG, but there's a PG. Lot of like smoking and swearing, murdering of ghosts.
I thought for some reason, and this, it's I'm a dummy. I thought it was PG-13, and I was kind of blown away because I remember that movie playing really well, not just with adults, but also with kids, because obviously when that movie came out, we were kids. And of course, it had this incredible marketing campaign around it, which I don't really see too often with movies these days in terms of like toys, spin-off cartoons, cereal, things like that.
Right.
And I remember when that movie came out, there were two very different cartoons. One was like based on Ghostbusters, and one was called The Real Ghostbusters, I believe.
The Real Ghostbusters was based on Ghostbusters. The other thing had like a big ape. And that was just called Ghostbusters. And I forget that there was a reason for all that, that they were.
But how hilarious that like someone's like totally riding the coattails of Ghostbuster success. Like, no, we need this cartoon needs an ape. Yeah. We got to get the naming rights before they do. So they have to call themselves the real Ghostbusters.
The real even Ghostbusters.
Though if you're DVRing that shit back in 88, you know, you're not going to be able to find it. Just
also
by
congratulations.
Type in real.
Congratulations.
No, because I invented.
On inventing the DVR.
You know my invention? The DVR? The TiVo? Doug TiVo Show. That was my nickname in junior high.
I forgot we used to call you TiVo.
That's right.
I also saw a movie called Pontypool, which is a Canadian horror film that's available.
You've never seen that
before? I had never seen it.
Okay.
I had heard about it for years. It showed at a massacre one year in the early years when I used to go with Erica, and we would leave about halfway through because she's a quitter. Before we started doing the podcast, I wouldn't necessarily stay. So I didn't see it there. I had not caught up with it, and then reading Melissa Henderson's article reminded me that I need to see it. So,
okay, time out for a second. I do want to hear your take on Pontypool. It is early September.
Correct.
And you are watching horror films.
Yeah.
When you know that come October 1st is what we like to call Scary Movie Month at F This Movie.
Yes.
It's a whole month dedicated to watching horror movies. If you haven't participated in the past, it is the most fun you'll ever have in your life, including the time you lost your virginity, your wedding night, and the time your child was born. All pale in comparison. why are you watching? You're going to blow your load, so to speak, or burn out, more so to speak, than if you when you watch stuff now. What happens come October 20th when you're like, I've got nothing to watch except – again, Pontypool Part 2, The Return of the Durant.
I really don't see that happening. I don't think I'm only going to watch scary movies in September, but I...
What about October?
October for sure. But I watched like 4 scary movies in the last 2 days and American Beauty. I don't know. The weather got... The temperature dropped in Chicago and it hit like the 60s and that was it. I was done. It might as well be October for me now. So
yeah.
I'm unable to contain myself. So yeah, I watched Pontypool. I watched Bones starring Snoop Dogg. I did it.
I saw earlier today you were wearing your Monsters t-shirt also. You're like already decked out in your October Halloween wear.
Yeah, listen.
Which is crazy because in California right now, specifically in LA, it is over 100 degrees today. It is unbearable. I went outside to do something and came back in drip sweating like a pig. Yeah. I am a disgusting pig.
This will be your first October in LA where it doesn't feel like fall, right?
I'm really bummed out. And the good news is, and not to talk weather at this forecast.
That's what the F stands for. Forecast this movie.
The nights here so far are awesome. Like they're once the sun sets, it really does cool down quickly, which is great. But I mean, during the day, it's unbearable. I really can't stand it. And I know come February, it'll be great because you guys will be like, all like, I hate the snow. And I'll be like, snow, I'm at the beach with Pam Anderson and David Hasselhoff. Cause that's, I haven't been here for summer yet. I just assume that that's what's or winter, yeah.
Yeah. So I saw Pontypool.
Oh, right, Pontypool.
It's interesting. I mean, I like what they're going for.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You saw it?
Yeah, I saw it probably 2 scary movie months ago.
Oh, you're so much better than
me.
Yeah, no,
I don't know. I like watching movies.
I had never seen
Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, I liked what they were going for. I think ultimately it goes to a place where it takes a pretty big leap, and I don't want to say what. There's sort of a twist, and I don't want to say what it is, but I think...
You can tell me, though, right?
Yeah.
Well, Okay, just between you.
I think when you find out what's causing the thing that's going on.
The Pontypool, yes.
Exactly. When you find out what's causing the Pontypool. It's the kind of thing that
ordinance, I believe, is the answer. A zoning ordinance.
It's the kind of thing that you're either going to say, "Hey, neat, what an inspired idea that I've never seen in a movie before," or you're going to say, "That's maybe more than I can swallow." Yeah. And I unfortunately landed in the second camp. So it went a little further than I was willing to go. But I don't fault anyone who likes that choice, because it is kind of a crazy choice that they make, and that's great. It was just more than I could handle. Bones.
Did you still enjoy it overall?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And again, it's a horror movie that is a lot different than a lot of other horror movies, you know. So if nothing else, you have to appreciate it for that. And I'm sure you love it because they don't really show anything. It's all just like suggested.
Oh,
and you don't like horror movies where you see anything at all.
Listen to the Others podcast, and you'll hear all about this. I am a fan of the imagination.
Yeah, I saw Resolution finally, which Eric Asperschlager had suggested in a Netflix This Movie column months ago, possibly a year ago. It's about two friends who kind of hole up at a cabin so that one friend can help his other friend get off drugs. Basically, his friend's a junkie, and it's not by choice. He like handcuffs him to a bed, and then weird shit starts to happen. And I won't say what. Again, it's a movie that I could appreciate, and it did some things differently than a lot of other movies. But at the same time, it reminded me of, do you remember me talking about Plus One?
Yes.
That movie where they're all at the party and like suddenly there's a clone of everyone. It was kind of like that. Hey, it's some interesting ideas, but didn't totally work for me as a movie. I still think it's worth checking out, you know?
Okay.
Revolutionary
Road. Okay, another Sam Mendes movie. Gotcha.
He is peeling back the curtain on drug-addicted suburbia. Hey, you saw Bellflower. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, I did see. That's right. I house sat for my sister-in-law as her she was having some work done, and I saw Bellflower and 21 and Over in one day. That's the double bill I go for.
Were these on Netflix, or does she own
both
those
on Netflix
movies?
Okay. No, she had some stuff on Netflix that I did I forgot honestly right now, but I was like, I'm not watching those, and I like was all snobby about it.
So you were going totally through her queue and watching like what was in
I was
her
going
queue?
Through so much of hers. Okay,
that's awesome. That's fantastic.
But no, I'm like such a snob about it. I'm not watching that. I'm watching Press Play 21 and Over. Bellflower, I remember watching a preview for it. I think I even featured the preview back when the little boy known as Doug did Watching Trailers with Doug, probably 2.5 years ago, or maybe just 2 years ago or so. Bellflower, the preview came out, and I thought it was a very different movie than what I actually ended up seeing. I remember liking the preview a lot because it kind of just suggested that these two guys are building this post-apocalyptic car, which they are doing in the movie, to take out, like, when the world eventually ends, they'll be the two survivors, kind of like in a road warrior type way. And the movie I got was very different. It's very indie twee, very the main character's name is Woodrow. And
yeah.
Listen, I'm all for experimental.
I'm all for Woodrows. Okay.
I'm all for Wilson, for example. I'm a huge fan of the League of Nations. Bellflower really, I was, and right as soon as I kind of figured out where it was going within the first 20 minutes, I was just kind of like, oh, and just kind of blankly stared at it for the next, you know, 90 minute runtime or whatever. It was not necessarily for me. I did like how it was shot. I thought the direction or the cinematography was good.
Yeah.
And it played around a little bit with the timeline and narrative, and it wasn't all bad. I'm not trying to like rip on Bellflower. It just wasn't necessarily for me, especially based on the trailer I saw, and also especially based on a lot of the fanboy adoration for this movie. People really love this movie. I'm not exactly sure why.
I kind of had a similar reaction. I thought it was well directed. Wasn't really for me. I can see, you know, the things that people are responding to. I understand why they are responding to it, even if I'm never going to respond to that.
Right.
I think there are some things that it says about friendship, about male-female relationships and like kind of jealousy and insecurity and those kinds of things that maybe, you know, some people who are really loving it are identifying with or speaks to some, you know, piece of their past. I don't know. So I understand why people love it. But yeah, I'm kind of in a similar boat. I thought it was...
I think for me too, it's some of it has to do with, again, expectations, and just my expectation was kind of a different movie. And as soon as I figured it out, like I said, I just wasn't in the mood for that kind of movie.
Right.
And maybe that's unfair to the movie that I didn't give it a fair shake, but I think I kind of know what it's about because I've seen, you know, enough to figure it out.
Right.
And then I saw 21 and Over, which is so stupid, but I like laughed a couple times. So I make no apologies for 21 and Over.
Good. Let's talk about American Beauty.
Have you seen 21 and Over, by the way?
I have not. I think it's in my Netflix queue along with 500 other movies. So there's a slim chance I'll ever get to it.
It's so not good. At one point, because I didn't finish it at my sister-in-law's, I brought it back and I was watching it one night. My wife walked in and I'm like, you know, I was kind of like, yeah, I'm watching this. And I didn't say too much about it, but she saw 2 seconds of it and was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And I'm like,
Is that the one where they have the friend who they call by the first and last name?
Yeah, it's their version of Mark Ahn, which I'd like to think that we came up with that first. It's Jeff Chang.
Okay.
And they get him drunk on his 21st birthday, and it's just a wacky series of things ensues. But,
and it's not found footage, right?
No.
That's just Project X, I think.
It's really just like a dumb, almost a throwback to a college, you know, rated R movie.
Right.
And it's definitely rated R. And I actually like one of the characters. I forget his real name. Not the guy from Pitch Perfect, but the other guy. He has a couple funny lines, but again, I'm talking way too much about 20 and Over. And this is even after you said, let's talk about American Beauty, which is why people are tuning into this podcast.
I'm not sure if it is. So American Beauty kind of has a reputation from some people for being the worst Best Picture winner. Some people say it's the greatest show on earth. Some people say it's Crash. Chicago. Some people have said it's American Beauty. And I would disagree with that. I don't think it's the worst Best Picture winner ever.
I don't think so either.
I really liked the movie in 1999, and I'm sure we'll get into what an incredible special year 1999 was, but I remember seeing the trailer and something really jumped out at me. I was pulling up the poster because I knew I was going to run it along with this podcast. And the poster is that very striking image of just sort of a navel and a rose, and it says, look closer. And I was like, boy, that's a really good marketing campaign. And then I was thinking back to the trailer, and what a good trailer it was, because I remember seeing that trailer for the first time in 1999 and turning to my then friend, future wife, and saying,
future girlfriend, yeah, future wife,
right, and saying that's going to be the best movie of the year. And I just read this book about DreamWorks, sort of the rise and fall of DreamWorks, called The Men Who Would Be Kings.
Wait, has DreamWorks fallen?
Yeah, basically they kind of sold off most people. I mean, it's still in existence, but they are not their own entity anymore. They are owned by other companies. It's called The Men Who Would Be Kings, and they spent a large amount of time on American Beauty talking about the release. It was a very calculated release, kind of limited, opening wider, very extensive campaign for the Best Picture award, which it ended up winning, so it worked, obviously. But, you know, they put together this impressive package, and Sam Mendes comes from the theater. He's making his feature directing debut. You've got Kevin Spacey, who at the time was about as hot as he could be. Annette Bening, Conrad Hall is shooting it. I mean,
Bane was also going to be in it, but then he had a different Strokes reunion to attend.
It has this very impressive pedigree. And when I saw the movie in 99, I was 22, probably. Yeah. And really liked it and went back to see it a couple of times. And I was amazed watching it this time that I didn't see through a lot of stuff in 1999. And I don't know if that had to do with the culture being different, that, you know, in those 15 years, which I can't believe it's been 15 years since the movie came out,
right,
that I've seen so much other stuff that either waters down American Beauty, you know, my tolerance for Kevin Spacey is eliminated. I've seen other movies do that same thing better. Or if it's just being older and kind of seeing through some of the nonsense that's in this movie, because most of it I felt like didn't work for me this time. And I know part of it is a function of, I just don't think the movie has aged well, which actually Aaron Mansfield, when I went back and looked up, you know, has anybody requested American Beauty? I found this email from Aaron Mansfield.
Boy or girl?
Boy. And he says exactly that. He writes a line. I used to love this film. I don't think it has aged well. And he's exactly right. I do not think this movie, I guess in 99, it felt sort of new and of the moment, but I don't think any of it still really feels honest in any way. And I've talked way too long. Your thoughts on American Beauty?
Before I chime in, I have a little trivia, and I swear to God, I do not have my phone in front of me.
I've got a little thing to say about 21 and over.
Have you heard about Jeff Chang and his night of debauchery on his 21st birthday? His dad is a ball buster. No, I have a piece. I remember this piece of trivia, and I hope I remember it correctly. The first movie DreamWorks ever put out.
The Peacemaker?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, The Peacemaker.
Yeah.
With George Clooney and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Which I still haven't seen. So if you want to pause it right about now, just pause it right now. And
oh, yeah.
Wow, The Peacemaker, guys. How about that? Huh?
I saw it opening weekend, and I remember liking it, although I've not seen it since, and I know it didn't do very well, which was a problem.
For DreamWorks.
They had a long run where they didn't really have a hit. I think American Beauty was really the thing that kind of opened them pretty wide.
I think you're right. And, you know, it's interesting talking about this movie, and obviously there's lots of conversations between you and me and you and whomever you're recording a podcast with about the movie itself. In terms of like what movie should we talk about next week or whatever. And I know we talked, this movie's been battered around between the two of us for a while now.
Yeah.
And I feel like whenever we've talked about this movie, just in kind of a preamble type way in terms of like, can we talk about this movie for a podcast, whatever, it always falls in that camp of, I feel like whenever you and I record a podcast, we always kind of have this conversation about like, does stuff hold up?
Yeah.
Like we'll talk about Garden State, about Goonies, about all these, Forrest Gump, for example, that we've taken older movies that are beloved by a lot of people, and most of them actually beloved by us still too, or not maybe still, but you know, like we think we remember liking these movies. So let's go back and watch these movies that we maybe haven't seen for 10 or 15 years. And it's interesting because in most of the other situations, for example, Garden State and Forrest Gump, I feel like when I watched them again, I was able to see through a lot, kind of like bouncing off of what you said earlier in terms of like, I'm surprised I wasn't able to see through a lot of this nonsense, you know, when back in 1999, watching, of course, Garden State and Forrest Gump, it's like, yeah, I'm seeing through some stuff now, and some stuff is really played, and some stuff is whatever. But for whatever reason, in a lot of those situations, I feel like the movie still works, and or there's something about it that still resonates with me. I know we talked about this a lot with Garden State specifically, and I think that's more because it's about maybe the characters were around our age and just what it had to say about certain really dumb things, obviously now, but we still have nostalgia for those movies. So we kind of still, even though we can rip them down and kind of nitpick and pull them apart, I feel like there's still something there that we can kind of sink our teeth into. Now, what I found interesting was watching American Beauty recently for the purpose of this podcast, I was kind of expecting that to happen also. And I did not get it whatsoever. I had such a cold response to this movie.
Yeah.
And it was surprising to me because I remember defending this movie vehemently when I first saw it. And not to say it needed so much defending, but I remember a couple instances in which family members or friends of friends would say like, well, that movie, I saw that movie and it wasn't for me, and or it was so unrealistic. You know, of course, that's a really dumb kind of critique of any movie, especially a movie like this where I don't think they're necessarily going for realism. But I remember thinking back in 1999, so if you were 22, I was 21 or maybe 20, that being such a big fan and being so kind of supportive of this and like, wow, it blew my hair back. And now I'm watching it just being like, oh my God, this is just so two things. One, it's like of the moment, like of 1999, all the bells and whistles and tricks. And I think there are some things, and we'll get to this, there are some things it does well, but also just how it's – I feel like it's just an empty movie. I feel like there's not anything to it.
It is, and yet it's a movie that I think thinks that it's saying a lot. And that, again, that was very similar to my reaction, that I felt very removed from all of it, that it was like watching this weird technical exercise where none of the things were really clicking into place, where this character seems to be of a different movie than this one, and these performances are suddenly all about acting instead of creating a believable human being. I mean, I remember at the time, and this movie came close to doing that whole sweep that that only One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Silence of the Lambs have done in the last 30 to 40 years, which is like picture
you're
actor.
You're talking about Academy Awards.
At the Oscars, yeah. I'm sorry. Picture actor, actress, director.
Supporting.
Screenplay? No, not supporting. Picture, director, actor, actress, screenplay. I think those five.
It didn't win actress.
It did not win actress. Hilary Swank won for Boys Don't Cry, which is a...
I can't believe Annette
vastly
Bening.
Superior film. and at the time, of course, I had no problem with any of it. I was like, yeah, sure, because I cared about the Oscars and I thought Kevin Spacey was good. And he still has an ability to do... Some of his lines, I think, are still... Or some of his deliveries, I think, are still funny in that sort of withering, condescending, sarcastic... Yeah. Way that he does. And again, maybe it's a function of having seen 15 more years of this performance from him, or really disliking him on House of Cards, but I'm immune to so much of what he does now that even the moment where he's driving a little car around and goes, "I rule," I used to think that was really a funny moment and something I felt like I hadn't seen in a movie. And this time it felt so much like an actor doing a shitty line. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, let me now not defend American Beauty, but I'll also say this, and I think that this might, your example about the I rule might fall into this category a little bit. And please stop me if I drone on too long. I do feel like a lot of the movie in 1999, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it was kind of new and was like, really, like you just said, I haven't seen this before in a movie. I haven't seen him say that. I've not seen this character. I've not seen this. And I feel like in a lot of ways, it's harder to go back. And this is regarding any movie. When you go back and watch, you can't help but kind of look at it through the eyes of a person with 15 years of like movie watching education and knowledge. That's why, you know, you kind of have to remind yourself, because Citizen Kane is the kind of movie that rules. I really think it's an awesome, awesome movie. But if anything, like you say, like, well, what's when people kind of, I can't believe I'm talking about fucking Citizen Kane in comparison to American Beauty, by the way. My point simply is this. Citizen Kane did a lot that had never been done before. That's, I'm just going to make it really simple and whatever. And I'm not comparing the two because American Beauty is, I don't think is a very good movie, especially now. But I want to kind of try to find the other perspective, you know, and I know on this podcast you've prided yourself on not just tearing stuff down, not just looking for the faults, but also trying to find the positive. And I feel like some of these things, like I think the lighting is really great in this movie. I feel like the color, the contrast, all that stuff's really great. I think that the music, and here's something interesting, the tubular type bells that are the music in this movie, that was the first time that kind of music was in a movie. And I remember... Now it seems so played, and now it seems so like I've heard this a million times because I have, and just like all of us have. We've heard this bell soundtrack, the background, a million billion times in every preview and every whatever. It's kind of the equivalent to the Christopher Nolan boom in the trailers.
Right.
And I remember specifically after this movie came out, Pay It Forward was the first movie that I remember ripped that off wholesale. Like every musical cue in Pay It Forward is taken directly from American Beauty. And it was like, wow, that's crazy. But again, in 2014, we're able to say like, well, even the music doesn't really resonate with me. But again, back in 1999, I feel like I'm trying, again, really trying to put myself in a different mindset to say like, well, it was unique at the time. And now it just, I'm not distracted by it anymore. So I'm able to see through all that bullshit and now kind of go and focus on the meat, which there is none.
Is it right? I mean, I guess the movie thinks that it's sort of exploring this dark underside of suburban life and how people who sort of pass by you every day and seem perfectly normal and happy or ordinary, as the movie kind of calls out, can actually be, you know, full of angst and misery. And I know at the time, one of the big pushbacks that you and I were dealing with in terms of talking to people who didn't like this movie was that they were really put off by the subplot about Kevin Spacey wanting to fuck his daughter's teenage friend. And that to me is one of the things that still works. If that's a very weird thing to say, But I think there is an honesty to that, that this middle-aged man fetishizes this pretty teenage girl. I think the movie kind of knows how to handle some of that, the dark comedy of that. There's a little some bit of it, like, yeah, him sneaking around and being a buffoon, but I think it recognizes that it's A, fucked up, and B, funny in the way that it's framed in the movie. I don't think there's anything, you know, necessarily funny about a 45-year-old guy wanting to fuck a teenager, but I'm saying the movie is able...
Just wait till you're 45.
The movie is able to find some humor in that. And that was a big pushback at the time, that people, oh, that's so gross. It's like, all right, well then, I guess this isn't the movie for you.
Well, exactly. I think in those situations when people, and I mentioned before, like, some people like complain to me, it's not realistic. And so, you know, like, they don't understand suburbia. If they think all suburbans are, you know, are crazy or, you know, weird like that, then they, you know, it's like, well, that's not what this is about. And if we can't even agree on the terms of the movie, like, I'm not going to convince you that it's a good movie. But yeah, I remember thinking that, like, everything you said in terms of the darkness and the humor, with the exception of, like you said, when he the buffoonery, like when he like prances away from his daughter's door, or like calls, or not calls the friend, but when he
does call her, the friend though.
I know, but I actually don't mind that scene. But when he offers her a ride, he's like, "I've got a car. You want to?" It's just like, yeah, it's so just like, he's like a salivating dog, and I'm like, "Oh, this is unrealistic," and just again taken from like an acting workshop as opposed to a real character, you know.
You had brought up the music, which is Thomas Newman, and there
was Ian Nicholas.
There were a handful of movies that you and I would constantly. This was one, Saving Private Ryan was one, and The Matrix. I think those were the three where we would be seeing a movie, and they would rip it off in some way. They would do that weird the Saving Private Ryan effect, that kind of stutter editing.
You're not talking about music in all three examples. You're talking about in Saving Private
they
Ryan.
They would pull this one effect. Stylistic thing, right? In The Matrix, obviously, it's, you know, bullet time or moving the camera around 360 degrees. And in American Beauty, it's
the fight choreography.
It's the music. And so, like, anytime we would see one of those things being imitated, we would turn to each other and say, like, oh, Saving Private Ryan ruined movies, you know. Because for 5 to 10 years, these movies cast a big shadow in terms of, again, people were just ripping off the music. I don't think there was a lot about American Beauty that really got ripped off, except for the music. But the music is one of the things that still works for me. I think the music is really good. I like you said, I love the photography. I think it's a visually, I think it's a very pretty movie. And some of that is Conrad Hall, and some of that I think is Sam Mendes really trying to...
It was his first feature film, right?
Yeah, and really trying to think in terms of making theater? A movie. Yeah, No, you know, because a lot of times, I won't say theater directors make movies that are stagey, but certainly when they're adapting plays, you end up with movies that are just kind of stagey. So I feel like he was trying to be somewhat cinematic.
Yeah.
So I do think that there are some things that the movie does well. I think there are some scenes that still work, some moments that still work. I've lost my taste for Alan Ball's screenplay, and it's interesting, having seen his output since American Beauty, especially like True Blood, you get a better sense of what a lunatic hack he kind of is. But there are still some lines in American Beauty that ring so true, like when they're in the car going to see that game to see Thora Birch do her cheerleading act for the first time. And Kevin Spacey's complaining, and he says, "And I'm missing the James Bond marathon on TNT." Like, that's such a hyper-specific observation that really works. I think the dance that they do, which I believe was choreographed by Paula Abdul, and I can't...
Correction, it was choreographed by MC Scat Cat.
Oh, sorry. And I can't tell, like, is she horrible, or does she understand the joke? Because the choreography is so bad in such the exact right way.
It's perfect. That's such a great way to. Oh my god! I'm thinking the first thing that came to mind was Mark Wahlberg singing in Boogie Nights.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, is he such a great actor that he's singing off key on purpose, but just perfectly enough, or is he really just that bad?
Right.
I don't know. In both situations, I don't know the answer.
Right. Was she trying to do good choreography that came across utterly mediocre, or did she understand the joke? But it's perfect. And I've rambled, but the one thing that I will call out that I really liked this time, and that I have always liked, my favorite performance in the film has always been, and continues to be, the one person I feel like came away unscathed in this viewing? Do you have a guess?
Thora Birch.
Mina Suvari.
Thora.
I think Mina Douglas Suvari is the unsung hero of American Beauty. I have always really liked her performance. I think she really gets something right about the specific kind of teenage girl that she's playing. And I think it has always come down to her delivery. And I apologize for those of you who are sensitive. Some girls say some nasty things to her at school. There is a pause and she fires back this pathetic, desperate cunt. And it's so perfect in the way that she says it. It's so hurt and desperate. I don't know. I think she's really, really good. And there are times where the movie doesn't trust her to get the material across. So it has her, like, go a step too far, say something too conceited or too self-absorbed, or she's like, I don't know what's wrong with him. He didn't even look at me once. It's like, we get it, okay? She's self-absorbed. She has a high opinion of herself. The screenplay a lot of times doesn't trust you to understand these characters or their motivations, and so they become very explicit at times.
I don't know much about Alan Ball, but I just, like you mentioned, his resume, I think before American Beauty, he wrote Grace Under Fire, the sitcom with that female comic. I forgot her name.
Brett Butler.
And not Rhett Butler.
No.
This has got to be the third time that her name has come up on this podcast, by the way. And he also wrote Sybil, and he wrote American Beauty. I think his conception was that this should be a play. And in a lot of ways, it feels like a play in terms of like the broad characters, the broad strokes, the kind of the gay neighbors, the, you know, and the military neighbor, like Colonel, his name is.
We got to spend some time on those neighbors. We'll get there.
But my point is, even in the writing of it, it's just kind of like, this feels kind of like, well, you need to carve out these characters and, you know, in such a broad way that it works on a play where you're sitting 80 feet away from the characters. So, you know, that guy was in the Marine Corps and that guy's gay. And I don't know much about Towelhead. I never saw it. I think that was his directing debut too. Yeah. But I know he also did 6 Feet Under, which you're a fan of, and True Blood, which you're not.
No, 6 Feet Under is fine. I'm not the world's biggest fan.
Okay. But it's funny that you almost think like I knew most of this stuff in the back of my head, but going and researching for the purpose of the podcast, I was like, well, Alan Ball must have done a bunch of other great scripts based on this one and based on the access, because sometimes it's not even so much the success of the movie kind of gives him opens doors, if you will, for a screenwriter. And, you know, you can get lots of things published. You have lots of other ideas. And I don't know if he has – I don't know what other ideas he has, honestly, because this movie, again, is – I just feel like, I don't know, the writing is very poor. Now, as far as the acting, you said that the character who comes out unscathed is Mina Suvari, and I tend to agree. Watching Annette Bening ham-fist her way through every ridiculous scene, and I get that it's equal parts her performance and equal parts like what she's given, the character that she's given.
Yeah.
But I was, every time she's on screen, I'm like, what the hell? Like, what movie is she in? What am I watching?
It's really problematic. And again, in 99, it didn't bother me because I was like, well, she's playing this awful high-strung thing. And seeing it this time, I really had problems with it. And it's an even bigger issue that she's playing opposite Kevin Spacey in most scenes, who is doing something not as broad, but sort of as broadly drawn. He's at a different pitch, but they both basically only have one pitch for the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah.
They have, you know, the one good scene where he's turned on by her and they start to make out and she says, I'm going to spill the beer. And he's like,
that's a great scene.
It is. Again, there are those moments that come through. You know, she has that scene where she's trying to sell the house and she fails. And so she smacks herself and is like, shut up, you suck or whatever. You know, I'm paraphrasing. And that's another one of those. That's another one of those moments where the movie just does not trust you to understand the self-loathing that drives her or how hard she is on herself to succeed. You know, all of that shit is coming through without watching her slap herself in the face.
Right. It's so cartoonish and over the top.
Yes.
And yet at the end of the day, it's like, well, aren't we just talking about some like these characters are not incredibly deep, but they're drawn again with such, I hate to keep using the same expression, like broad strokes, but they're drawn with such broad strokes that you think like, wait, there has to be more to this than just, oh no, her beating herself up is pretty much exactly what I'm getting tongue tied right now, but every time she was on screen and did like something ridiculous or some weird choice or said something. And I feel like Annette Bening, I know you're not a fan, right?
Not particularly.
I like her a lot in, I can name one movie where I like her a lot.
It's The American President. And she's great in that, which, you know, as somebody who's generally not a fan, the fact that she overcomes my resistance to her and she's very good in that movie is a testament to her performance.
Right. And that movie, I know certain members of the staff aren't fans. I actually really like that movie, flaws and all. I think that's a really enjoyable movie.
Of course, me too.
It's dated and aged and has problems, but whatever. We all like what we like. But Annette Bening in that movie, that was maybe one of my first introductions to her as an actress. And I was like, oh, wow, I kind of like her. Even though, like, in lots of ways, I probably shouldn't, just with, like, her mannerisms are always the same in every movie. It just, I don't know why it worked in that movie and not in whatever. I don't know. But as far as her in this movie, I mean, it's so just over the top and mannered. And again, if they're going for, why don't you take over right now?
There's a lot of performances that are mannered. I would say Thora Birch is not. I know you had brought her up. And I don't think Mina Suvari is, but Kevin Spacey is very mannered. Annette Bening is very mannered. Chris Cooper, I think, is very mannered. Allison Janney is wasted in a crazy, ridiculous role.
Allison Janney's great.
Wes Bentley's character makes no goddamn sense. Like, how I ever accepted that in 1999 and was like, yeah, he's a person. because he's not. He's a weird, staring stalker in one scene. And then in the next scene, he's totally relaxed and talking about how he sells weed on the side. And all of those things could make for a really interesting character. I just don't think it clicks. I mean, I like when Thora Birch says he's so confident, but she's describing a character that I don't think quite comes across
on screen.
He's one of these characters that there's a word for this or a term that has recently come up, and I don't know what it is, so forget that I brought it up. He's one of these characters that is whatever he has to be for the needs of the scene.
Sure.
And that doesn't work. There's no consistency to him. It's like whatever the scene needs him to be at that moment, that's what he is.
Right. In so many scenes, he's the connection between all the characters. But you realize when you take a step back and you look and you say, like, well, that would never. And again, I'm not trying to take the argument of the people in 1999 who said that's not realistic. But I think in some respects, you have to have some sort of realistic character. They can't just vacillate so far back and forth between, like you said, he is like a creepy stalker. And then he, again, goes to this, like, where he said there's one scene where they're smoking pot outside. And he quits his job and he's like, you're my hero. And then he like has the scenes with his dad and he's like a different character because it's all, he's just the foil, like trying to get the emotion out of whatever person he's acting opposite of.
Right. I mean, I like the idea of him being sort of this oddball observer, someone who appreciates Thora Birch in a way that obviously her parents don't. And obviously the people at school don't, and sees her instead of seeing Mina Suvari. I mean, all that stuff in theory could work, but and part of the problem, I think, with him is that he is our connection to the whole Chris Cooper storyline, which is kind of disastrous. I think
everything about that family is just like out of like, again, it feels like a play in so many respects, like the way the house looks, the way Allison Janney. Again, I like Allison Janney. I think she's a great actress. I'm a fan, and this is like this a poster board of a person could have played that part, and I think that's the point. But why have Allison Janney, who brings all this talent to the role, just like stare off on the screen? But it gets to a point where it's just like, well, that's. I'll take a step back, and I hope I don't want to steal your story, but you had mentioned to me that you had recently seen something. You are a member of the Chicago Critics Society, and as such, you have to judge films. Can I talk about this, by the way?
I think so.
Okay, you just said you saw a movie that you weren't a fan of about alcoholism.
Yes.
And in the movie, there's bottles in every scene, like empty, tipped over bottles. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and so I feel like in this scene, it's like, yes, we need to show that this character is just merely a cipher for the crazy, strong-willed father-husband character, and she is an empty, defeated, you know, soulless whatever. And it's like, everything that they're showing me is so over the top and ridiculous that I can't, like, well, you're not even showing me a character. And again, I'm not saying it has to be real, like, it's not realistic, because I get that there's art, way more art involved in a movie like this than just with, like, a regular wide release or whatever. But that character is so far beyond my comprehension, I don't know why it's even in the movie, or why the Chris Cooper character, too.
Yeah, well, listen, you know.
I went down a weird path there.
No, sorry. That's fine. Alan Ball, you know, clearly has an agenda, and I don't mean that in a weird political way. He has something that he wants to say about homosexuality, about feeling like an outsider. I'm 90% sure that he is a gay man. I don't want to say that for certain, but I'm almost positive. I would look that up, but okay, yes, he is a gay man. Thank you. So he's, and I'm not saying like, oh, he has this gay agenda, but he has.
Please tell me what your Google search just now was.
That
Alan Ball space gay.
Yeah, I just put gay ball, and that's what.
And an image search, and it was something.
He has some things that he wants to say about that experience. About the way that. About the way that, you know, homosexuals might be treated in America, in the suburbs, whatever. So a lot of the Chris Cooper thing plays into that. And it just – the movie eventually devolves into like this Three's Company misunderstanding that, you know, ends a life. We also need to talk about what this movie almost was. So I searched a little bit on Wikipedia because that's how I do. And – there's a whole paragraph on there about interpretations of the film, and that blows my mind because when I liked it in 99, when I'm not crazy about it now, I've never had a problem understanding or I don't think this is a movie with a lot of different meanings or potential readings. I think it's pretty much all on the surface. One of the things that this Wikipedia summary posits is that the movie is about different forms of imprisonment, that we're all imprisoned by certain things. Kevin Spacey is imprisoned by his ordinary suburban life, his job, and his unhappy marriage. And Annette Bening is
that's so like 101. It's like,
oh yeah, oh for sure. So yeah. Chris Cooper obviously is ultimately, we learn, is imprisoned by his own repressed homosexuality, right, which is such a miscalculation. Allison Janney, I guess, is like somebody who's literally imprisoned within her own body. Right, right. So he's maybe trying to show different forms of imprisonment. None of it works. None of it works.
You know, there recently was an article in Huffington Post with Alan Ball about the 15-year anniversary of this movie, which is, again, going back to, like, I can't believe this movie is already 15 years old. Just makes me feel very old. And how one of the paragraphs in the – and I don't have it right in front of me, but it was a similar thing, like how – people have interpreted this movie differently over the years, and it's got all these different themes that you might not be as aware of. And I'm just like, again, looking back, I'm like, I think what you said is perfect. Like, when I loved it in 99 and when I'm very kind of turned off by it in 2014, I've never been confused by it.
No, it's 100% on the surface.
Right. And I feel like when we talk about like the spirituality, like one of the things is like, it's about spirituality and about awakening. And I'm like, yeah, okay, but that's because you might as well have a character saying like, I'm awakening spiritually, you know?
They kind of do.
I know.
So I like the idea.
Bellflower more credit. I give Twin Over more credit.
I like the idea at the center of Kevin Spacey as this miserable middle-class suburban guy. I mean, that line at the beginning where he's masturbating in the shower and says, like, this is the high point of my day. But he says it in, like, a southern accent. He's like, this is the high point. I can't do it. I hate that show. That's funny, you know. And I like...
Daphne, you're either the matador or the doormat.
I like the idea of this guy who just kind of says, fuck it. And starts working out and starts smoking pot and buys this car and gets a job at a fast food place. All of those things are kind of funny, this idea of him rebelling against his role in suburbia. And so that's like some of the stuff.
All beneath the surface and not. Oh, yeah, wait, I'm right? sorry. He actually quits his job and works out and buys the old Firebird.
Everything is 100% on the surface. But
which is fine, by the way, because it's an interesting thing. And I like to see where this is going. But when you introduce the Annette Bening character and like all these opposing elements that are like, well, that's not real. When everything is kind of thrown together, it's like, what a mess of a movie when everyone is performing.
Yes.
When it feels like Sam Mendes, who I don't dislike Sam. I like Road to Perdition fine. I like, what did he just direct recently? Shoot, Skyfall. I can't think of it. Skyfall, right.
Away We Go. Did you like Away We Go?
Yeah, I did. That's with John Krasinski, Jim from The Office.
Yeah, right.
And Oprah from SNL. Yes, this is how I cast movies in my head. I'm like Jim from The Office and Oprah from SNL. But I feel like it's definitely like, and you said before, he's trying very hard as a first-time director coming from the theater to do certain theatrical things. But it's also, in a lot of ways, film school 101. And you could tell he's had a lot of these ideas in his head. I know there's been people out there talking about first-time screenwriters, how they, whenever you watch a script, when you watch a movie of a script of a first-time screenwriter, I think you even talked about this. I'm going to give you credit because I think this is where I got this from in my head right now. When you, in your review of Don John, you could check out the review, Patrick's review of Don John and fthismovienet, .net.
fthismovienet.
fthismovienet.com. Where you say you could tell when a person's got this movie inside them and they have been working on it in their head for years and years and years and years, and all these ideas come out, and it's even when it's not the most successful movie like a Don John, it's still incredibly interesting to watch. There's all these things on display and things you might not have seen before. And I definitely think that was the case with American Beauty. It just hasn't aged well. It seems of the moment of the time back in 1999. But again, it's the director directing his first movie and not maybe having the courage or the strength or the confidence to kind of correct those mistakes. But what the hell do I know? It won an Oscar. I mean,
well, only good movies win Oscars.
Yeah.
It's weird because in 99, it really felt like a prestige movie, but not in that way that like now
like
when
the King's Speech.
Yeah. Like now when we see that, we're like, oh, we're so annoyed by prestige movies like that. It felt like a prestige movie that felt very contemporary in an interesting way. I mean, I thought that at the time. And again, maybe chalk that up to youth and inexperience. I don't know. But none of that holds true anymore, and maybe that's just a function of the movie not aging, or maybe I was just wrong about it. Is it possible for a movie to like be good in 1999 and bad now?
Well, what I'll say, and this doesn't answer your question.
A good movie is timeless, right? Like a good movie is a good movie.
But what I will say, I think, and I, without repeating myself, although I'm going to, it's of the moment. It's 1999. It's that movie captures so much of
our obsession with video recording,
one CCD chip cameras. There are many, many better films from 1999, but I feel like this movie, and I'm actually in a weird way. Okay. Let me take a step back. The Oscars are bullshit. The Oscars suck. Academy Awards, like who fucking cares about the Academy Awards?
Right.
It's proven to be just a popularity contest and a money contest in politics and whatever. And there was a time when I cared, and I don't anymore. Even so much, I don't even care about the jokes and the pomp and all that stuff. All that stuff is like, I don't care. It makes me furious these days. But I will say I am glad in a weird way that this won the best Oscar picture from 1999, because in so many ways, like you said, like a King's Speech, the King's Speech is engineered to win an Oscar, and it won an Oscar, and it doesn't tell you anything about what year was it made? 2011?
2010.
Doesn't tell you anything about that year when The Social Network, which should have won, would be such a better movie. And this might be the wrong reason for a movie to win an Oscar, even though I think The Social Network is a superior movie to The King's Speech. I think it should have won for that reason and that reason alone. But it's got the added benefit of being like a movie that feels like it's from 2010 as opposed to King's Speech, which could be made in any decade since, you know, World War II, basically. And I feel like in a weird way, American Beauty, it's like, no, that movie's perfect. And maybe I'm being a little sarcastic. That movie's perfect for 1999 because that is what we got in 1999. The argument being like, there's a lot better movies, obviously, that should have won. But this movie kind of captures all this stuff because look at what it brought to the table, like the music, the cinematography, the kind of culture, the shadow that it cast, as you said earlier. Look at all these things that it brought, and how we look back on it now and be like, oh, what a trifle, what a weird little thing from 15 years ago.
And that's the thing, when you say Social Network, you know, had something to say about 2010, I think it had something to say about life in 2010, about a specific sure. technological explosion. And American Beauty, I don't think, says anything about 1999 in terms of like who we were as a society. I think all it has, I agree with you that it captures 99, but only in the package that's been put together. You know what I mean? Like these yeah. elements, not any themes, not, I would never watch it and say like, oh yeah, that's what life was in that, that's year. It's just about like, well, Kevin Spacey was at the top of his game, so he's the lead, and Sam Mendes was plucked to do this. Even the idea of this being sort of the DreamWorks prestige movie that they were pushing to win the Oscar, it says everything something about movie, that. Yeah,
everything about this movie in 1999 was novel, and I think that that's what I'm referring to in the disclaimer. Like, I think you're completely right. Let me correct my statement. The disclaimer being like, I don't really agree with the themes. I don't think they're saying anything. I mean, it's definitely not saying anything new about suburbia, because suburbia was messed up back in the 50s and the right. 60s. It's not like in 1999, it's like, whoa, what's up with the suburbs?
Thanks for peeling back the curtain, Sam Mendes.
I hope you do it again in your next movie. So it's not the themes, it's not even, but it's the package. It's right. it's the music, it's the actors, it's the director, it's the approach to the award season that this movie put together. It's the studio that put it together. It's like, well, that all feels, even as so much as the wardrobe and stuff like that. I remember there was a scene in which Mina Suvari, and this is very specific and kind of maybe a little off topic, but she's wearing like a canteen backpack and these like really high platform sneakers. And it's like, well, yeah, that was, no one wears that now. That's from 1999. Right. And that fits in perfectly with this movie, because everything else is of that time too.
And so maybe removed from all of that, all that's left now, once it's pulled from that context, all that's left is the movie, you know, like the right. elements, the package, that's all gone. Now all we have is the script
exactly.
and the performance. And it's like, oh, there's nothing there.
Right. There's nothing there. Everything's on the surface. The performances are all over the top. It feels like in a way he's being cinematic and, very movie maker, but in a lot of ways it's very theatrical in terms right. of the theater presentation. And you mentioned before, and let's get to this right now, Alan Ball, in terms of the script, like what, and this further proves he's a psycho, what he wanted to do versus like what actually, and by the way, the version we got is the best possible version of his script.
I believe that to be true, because at the time when we found out that the movie was meant to open with Kevin Spacey, he's narrating from the dead, you know, from beyond the grave, which we find out, but the movie was meant to open with his disembodied spirit, like in a bathrobe, floating over the suburbs. And there was a whole third act in which Thora Birch and Wes Bentley are framed for the murder by Chris Cooper yeah. and stand trial and, I believe, go to prison.
That makes perfect sense. Here's what you want in a movie. You want the ghost. It's like a Mr. Show sketch, by the way. It's like he's in a bathrobe and a ghost yeah. flying around. And by the way, just a quick comment on like voiceovers. Like, should any best picture of the year, I'm using air quotes, any best picture have like narration to tell us what we're supposed to feel and like to convey the very serious themes? Like, believe, like in the coda, I'm getting off topic, but the coda yeah. of the movie where it's kind of like, I am happy, like after he's, spoiler, yeah. after he's murdered.
Right.
He's like, I'm happy. And you might look at me and say, why? He's like, I'm happy for all the things I did and all my experiences. And if you don't understand, don't worry, you will. It's so like, it informs, I'm okay, take over.
No. To me, it suggests, and it's Alan Ball's script, so obviously it was taken over and reshaped by Sam Mendes, I assume in the editing room. I don't know how much of that material actually got shot, but to me it suggests that he, I won't say didn't know whose story it was, but obviously intended it to be someone else's story, because once Kevin Spacey, I mean, to me it's Kevin Spacey's story, and so once Lester is dead and out of the picture, why would we continue seeing a trial where two people are framed for a murder? This isn't a movie that should be about getting away with a crime or framing your own children. It makes no sense given the Chris Cooper character that we know, that he becomes some sort of criminal mastermind. I'm not interested in seeing two innocent people sent to prison.
You're not.
So it becomes their movie, I guess, and that's very different and very uninteresting. For some reason,
there was another thing too. You mentioned the two things, like the ghost Lester Burnham and the framing of the, and of course we've got the whole kind of confession on tape. That's what opens the movie, and that's what repeats later in the movie. And of course it makes sense. But you've also got, there was also another, I don't know if this was ever shot. I don't think so, because this even seems more far-fetched. But there was another thing that was, there was the Chris Cooper character was going to, like, a whole subplot about he had a gay lover in Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was a whole thing with that, too. And I don't know, again, I don't know how they would shoot that. That's why I think maybe it was just more in the Alan Ball kind of outline, like, of his, again, when you're sitting on a movie for so long and you're working on something for almost a decade. In terms of, I think he came up with the idea, in quotes, for the movie in 92 after the Amy Fisher, Joey Buttafuoco thing, the scandal that broke. That's when he came up with the idea for this movie, that the truth basically being that the truth lies somewhere in between all the different interpretations and things that we're seeing about this glamorized story, that the truth is dirty and what, you know, look closer and all that stuff. But when you've been working on or stewing about something for almost a decade, you're going to have way more acts than you actually need, obviously. And you're going to have like lots of things. And if you said what you said before, I didn't know Alan Ball was gay. I do feel like he wants to say a few things about homosexuality. I don't think he says anything about homosexuality in this movie.
Well, what he says to me is a little bit troubling, because, you know, there's a stereotype that's rightly criticized, that a lot of times in movies, when you're presented with a gay character, it's gotten obviously much better, but, you know,
it's always Scott Bakula. Is that what
you're
going
to say? Throughout the '90s, there was this, a lot of times it was a lesbian character who turned out to be a crazy murderer. And
that was monster, if you will.
That was a trope that got used a lot. And I remember it being a big problem in Basic Instinct. And there were a few other movies. And so that, you know, people are right to criticize that. And like I said, I know that it has improved. We've seen more positive representations of gay characters in movies. But what this movie has to say to me is a little bit troubling, because while I know that, you know, closeted homosexuals have been driven to do terrible things because they can't deal with how they're feeling or their fear of society's rejection or whatever, they have done terrible things, hurt themselves, possibly hurt other people. What this movie says is, you know, because Chris Cooper is gay, he murders Kevin Spacey. And that to me is a problem.
Yeah. I actually like, there's a scene right before the murder where Chris Cooper, having just lost his son, just kicked his son out, for being gay, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously this cartoon character father who's in the Marine Corps can't handle and gives his son drug tests and all this stuff that's cartoonish and ridiculous, and I hate it. And then he kicks his son out after his son falsely admits to being gay because the father thinks he saw something that was different than it actually was. He thinks he saw his son and the neighbor engage in some gay act or something. It's a misunderstanding. Like you said,
during the Three's Company
Mr.
scene.
Mr. Furley comes out and is like, what?
Oh, Jack! Oh,
so the Regal Beagle. And Larry's like, hey, let's all get laid. And then he goes over, and I actually like the scene. And this is the one Kevin Spacey. Okay, there's lots of very mannered Kevin Spacey moments in this movie. And some of the things I still accept. I like when he grabs the asparagus. I think that's still like, it still works for me. But the one scene where I actually feel like he's let his guard down a little bit, when it was like, hey, it's okay. Like, what's wrong? Again, the whole scene is ridiculous, but I liked this specific Kevin Spacey kind of reaction to it.
Yeah.
Of course, that empathetic sympathy reaction is what gets him murdered also. Just like, because like, right. I'm not gay. Like, I'm, everything's okay. And like, he leaves and then he goes shoot that.
And again, even in 99, I always saw that scene as kind of disastrous, for a lot of reasons, but I just think it simplifies the Chris Cooper character in such a way where it's like, in that moment where he tries to kiss Kevin Spacey, we're supposed to say, oh, that's why he's the way he is. And
right.
And I think Alan Ball intended it to make him more complex, but I think it has the exact opposite effect. And I think it just simplifies him in such a way, and again, turns the movie into being about something very different.
No, and the scene sucks. You're right.
I agree with you about Kevin Spacey's performance. I agree.
Just how a little bit more like realistic, like, oh yeah, you'd have that kind of reaction. Like, he's not just being like,
whatever. And he's showing kindness. And here's one of the things that I picked up on this viewing was in 99, I don't mean to keep going back to that, but I don't know. I liked the movie and I felt like we were supposed to kind of be on Kevin Spacey's side, and his victories were our victories. And we liked seeing this guy who had been boxed in and beaten down, start to stand up for himself and feel liberated, even if it was, you know, the desire to have sex with a teenage girl that sort of started it. His little liberations when he tells his boss off and his little I ruled, you know, all of these things were small victories that we were meant to live through vicariously and enjoy. And watching it this time, he is a terrible asshole. The way that he fights with Annette Bening is so hostile and so mean-spirited that I no longer felt like he was a man standing up for himself. I felt like he was just a bully and a dick.
I'll go a step further.
As miserable as she is, no one deserves that.
No, not just the fight with Annette Bening, but the fight with his daughter, too. Like, there's one scene early on where he says, she's like, you've barely spoken to me in months.
Yeah.
And then he is angry later in the movie, and he's like, you two get whatever you want. And it's like, right. You are a horrible father. I'm
yes.
as a father now. Like, I think I might have known that back in 99, but I think it's even more glaringly obvious. Like, wait a minute. You have one daughter. You can't, like, there's a scene in which he talks to Mina Suvari and he's like, I can't, she died before she told me how she's feeling. And I'm like, oh my God, like, what? That's insane. But again, I mean, obviously we were all informed by our own experiences and stuff. And I had a very different, my father was not murdered by my gay neighbor. So maybe my experience with this movie is slightly different, but I feel like the way he even argues and talks down to his daughter is like, she is a victim in a lot of ways, a victim of her bully friend, a victim of her pushy mother, a victim of her bully father, and a victim of a psychopath neighbor, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I still, like you said, he's still just not a real person. So she's like, of course I'll move to New York with you. Like,
right.
And it's weird because Mina Suvari is like, no, you're going to end up like living in a box on the street. And I'm like, wait a minute. She's kind of right.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason that would make any sense. But I get when you're 17 and showing your boobs when you shouldn't be showing your boobs to a neighbor across the alley and to America that you make bad decisions, is my point.
And the movie is so quick to make everybody into one thing. And then I feel like it's trying to subvert some of those. You know, it reveals that Chris Cooper is a fraud because he's actually gay. And then it reveals that Mina Suvari is a fraud because she's not a slut. She's a virgin.
Right. And she's actually got a good heart.
Well, exactly. She's the only person to ask Kevin Spacey, like, how are you? And she's really good in that scene again. Her performance is the one thing that I think.
That scene is good. Scratch that. Delete that. That scene is horrible. Her performance is good. Can we talk about the end? Like, from the moment, like, he exposes her, like, takes off like Suvari's top.
Okay.
Yeah, like her boobs. And then, like, their reconciliation. Like, she said, it's my first time. And he's like, she's like, I want to let you know just in case I'm awful or whatever. And he, like, is like, no, no, no. By the way, I heard also that an earlier draft of the script had him going through with it also, which this further proves your point about him being a scumbag. But so she says, my first time, everything we are meant to believe about her is false. They somehow reconcile. They're in the kitchen together and they're like laugh. They're chummy about it.
Yeah.
And she's like, I feel embarrassed. And he's like, how's my daughter? And it's like, what is going on? And then Mina Suvari, who just had a huge argument with her, is like, she's doing really great. And all evidence to the contrary, like, she's pretty miserable because you're a miserable father. Right. And she's dating firmly believe, Mina Suvari, that this neighbor is a psychopath, this, regardless of whether he's attractive or not, or like that they have some connection. Like, I think he's kind of crazy. I'd be worried for you, Mr. Burnham, because I think your daughter is in danger from you and from the neighbors.
Yeah, but it's all solved one scene later when he's murdered with a smile on his face.
It seems to me that again, it goes back to the my first script, my first time directing. Like, everything is like, how do we resolve this? We're almost pushing 2 hours. And by the way, the movie feels very long. It's resolved in such a way that's like, well, of course he says no, and then put them in the make some like quick little aside, and everything's back to normal. And it's like, no, that's not how. And again, I'm not looking for realism, and I know I keep going back to that point because, again, my critique of those people in 99 was like, it doesn't have to be real. And again, maybe that's just dumb, stupid, uninformed Doug, that maybe you do need a little more human elements because otherwise these are robots.
In Once Upon a Time, I liked that the scene where Annette Bening goes upstairs and sees the clothes and kind of hugs them and lets out this awful noise. And it's still one of her better moments in the movie. But I was so distracted by the way that it's set up with red herrings and we're not supposed to know who shot Kevin Spacey. Why is it a mystery? And why
it's like Clue.
Right, exactly. Or maybe this is what happened.
Right. There's like a rewind sound effect.
And then her first move after finding her dead husband is to run upstairs and throw her gun away. It struck me as so false this time.
You know, that's a better way to put it. Not like it has to be real. I'm not looking for realism every step of the way, but I'm also not looking – nothing can be false. Even if you go an unrealistic way, because there's lots of movies that are fantastical, it can't be false.
Well, it can't be emotionally dishonest, and that's kind of what this movie is.
So much about this movie is false. Like, it's not even – I mean, yes, you're right, emotionally dishonest, but like even the point where like the gunshot happens and Wes Bentley walks out. And we're focused on him instead of the daughter, which I thought was an interesting choice.
Right.
And he stares at Lester Burnham's eyes because, of course, he does. Because earlier in the movie, he says about something about looking into the face of God,
right?
A dead person, when you stare at them and he smiles. And I'm like, right then, it's like, this is the most – like they're all fucked up robots from outer space.
Well, right. That beat is suddenly supposed to become about Wes Bentley seeing something beautiful, right? Because he's always looking for beauty. And so, look, he's seeing beauty in – Kevin Spacey's death mask. And that's a weird, I shouldn't be concerned with like him having a nice moment. Like you said, this girl just lost her daughter. When I was, lost her father, sorry. When I was, she miscarried also in that moment, which is a true tragedy.
Earlier draft of the script.
When I was 17 and a senior in high school, I took this creative writing class with a teacher that I was in love with. And for my final story, I worked really hard on it. I used to stay after school and work on it. I like showed her a draft and talked about it with her. It was like this.
I wrote it in my own blood.
It was this real collaboration. I was positive it was going to get either her or Jodie Foster to love me. So
Reagan's dead now. You win.
At the end of the story, the main character is shot and killed on a subway. And it was very much like this, where he's sort of still talking about, you know, hey, don't worry about me, I'm dead, but I'm looking up at the top of the subway and there's no graffiti on it. So it's all just a matter of perspective, right? American Beauty ripped me off is what I'm saying. My point is this. At the time, again, I was 17 and my teacher was, she was what, like 25, you know.
Yeah, 24.
So she was a little bit older and apparently old enough to know, hey, maybe you don't want to do that. To me, that strikes me as a cop-out, as like, you don't know how to how to end your story, so you kill your character. And I was 17, and I was like, no, this works. Trust me, this works. And I was proud of the story and whatever. And I watch this now, and I'm like, okay, this was written by 17-year-old me.
Yes. Can I just want to say, like, just to piggyback on that, we made a movie when I was in college, and it was awesome. Okay. If anyone's asking, it was the best movie ever.
It won Best Picture.
There's a thing I think with any sort of, with any story, the hardest part is the ending, unless you've got the ending first, in which case the hardest part is everything else. Am I right? But I think with any story, with any creative project, the hardest part is like how to resolve this in a satisfying way. And I know we had a long conversation about how do we end this little short film we're doing for a class project. And the reason why that's a false ending and why that's a cop-out, cheap way to go, which thank God this teacher said, like, yeah, maybe don't do that. Thank
God. Oh, no, I still did it.
Thank God. It's because it's the first thing that pops in your head.
Right.
Like, the first thing is most often probably not the best way to go. And I feel like if you just think harder and find a different element. If you look closer at this navel, you'll find something. You could find something a better ending. And I know that for our little short movie, which will be posted on fsmovie.net.com, Just kidding. No, it's you're more I was more satisfied with the ending we came up with. And just like this movie, and I mentioned before the closing denouement, like over voiceover, where he says, like, don't worry about me. Like, I know you might think I'm crazy for finding beauty in all this. And if you don't worry. Music stops, blackout, you will. And I'm just like, oh, that is probably why the movie I made was the movie I made. And the stories we wrote were the stories we wrote. Because, again, we're so informed by this kind of art and this kind of thing back in 1999 and the shadow it cast and the package it was. And then when you rip all that garbage away, you realize there's nothing here. There's nothing here.
Right.
You will, Patrick. Like, yes. Oh, my God. Here's the Oscar.
You're going to die, too. So I think part of the issue there is, and I wasn't even totally aware of this, that the original impetus for the screenplay was the Joey Buttafuoco case. And so that the movie that Alan Ball originally conceived and possibly wrote was about what the different events that led to this violent act. And so the murder of Lester Burnham became sort of the end game, that was what the movie was about. And then we see a little bit about the aftermath, but it was all this stuff that led to a crime, that was the movie that he wrote. And so once you take all that stuff out, because that's essentially what happened, the movie became about something very different. And yet the murder still stayed in the movie. And so now it doesn't work because it became something different. And in the process of becoming something different, that probably should have come out of it, but it didn't.
Yeah. No, I know it's funny now to think in 2014 to think back at like the names Joey Buttafuoco.
Sure.
Buttafuoco.
Whatever.
Buttafuoco.
Whatever.
Joey Buttafuoco and Amy Fisher. And I think one of the things he had mentioned in this article I read was to say, like, you know, I saw some tabloid that had Amy Fisher is like a Catholic schoolgirl, like a prim and proper nice girl next door, and Joey Buttafuoco as this hairy beast, you know, predator. And another tabloid had her all tarted up like Lolita, which, by the way, this movie borrows heavily from Lolita. Even I think the anagram of Lester Burnham's name comes from the main character in Lolita. But you've got Joey Buttafuoco is just like a nice family guy who's kind of taken in by this vixen, you know?
Right.
And he wants to find the thing in between. And again, all these are great aspirations and great ideas. And like, that's an interesting story. But what it comes out to being is like, no, you're just presenting us with like even the name American Beauty. I think it's based on a rose.
Yeah.
That is like, looks pretty on the surface, but is prone to rot in the roots.
And it's what?
Like, oh, I know. Like, you've blown my mind. Like,
there are so many interpretations.
There are so
movie.
Many layers.
I just have to look closer. I'm spent on this movie. Are you good?
Yeah, let me just get the last tissue here.
We never really did talk about 99 was such a good year for movies, and I at the
we'll
time
save it for another
thought,
podcast.
Yeah, I thought this was one of those, but it turns out it's not. This is one of those movies that we did keep putting off because I kept thinking, like, well, I don't know if I want to rewatch that movie because I don't think it's going to live up to my memory of it. And there are a few movies that we've talked about doing shows on that fall into a similar category. And I know eventually we'll do those movies, but Good Will Hunting is one.
Right.
And Fight Club is one where I'm like, oh, I bet if I rewatch it now, it's not going to be the movie that I saw at the time. Which, by the way, is okay. I mean, movies can certainly have an impact on us at a place in our lives and then not be those movies when we come back to them. You know, to me, the great movies are the ones that are either secretly great that you didn't realize at the time, that are still great, or that take on a new meaning. You know, hey, this was great to me in 99, and now here I see it 15 years later, and it's great in a different way or whatever.
Right.
And
right.
American Beauty obviously failed all three of those tests for me.
And I almost feel like I feel bad to my younger self because, again, I wouldn't say this movie meant a lot to me because I think that 99 had enough to offer, and I think at the time I was so kind of immersed being in college, being obsessed with movies, seeing everything the moment they came out. But I really was kind of smitten with this movie and a defender of it, and I almost feel bad to my younger self. Again, that really sounds stupid because now I watch it, I just feel nothing but emptiness. And I also like wonder, who is this movie ultimately for? Maybe I'm not even at the right age now. Maybe if I wait another 15 years, I'm 35 now, I'll be 50 in 15 years. Maybe then when I have grown children and, you know, a horrible wife. But I'm, you know, for real, like, who is this movie for? And I don't know if there's necessarily an answer for that, and nor does there need to be necessarily, but I do think it's a good question to ask sometimes. And I that's why I end up scratching my head. It seems like an exercise. It feels like just like you know, like I'm going to put on all these tricks in my screenplay and all these little tasty nuggets in my movie, and you're going to eat them up because you are smit with Kevin Spacey and you like this kind of this music and this package and all that stuff. And again, when you strip it away, you end up with just Jeff Chang.
Anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. Apologies to you fans of American Beauty. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Patrick. I look forward to doing another podcast with you very soon.
I look forward to being shot shortly after I press stop.
It's gonna happen.
Bye, guys. Bang.